Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by John Hodge and JC Abbott. Fellas, do you think we can hold ourselves to the high standard, or are we going to have a massive drop off and disappoint fans like the Saskatchewan Roughriders? What do you think?
I don't know. Is Kerfala Exumé on the podcast this week?
We mentioned him.
Kerfala Exumé, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show, is a super nice guy and an awesome special teams player. And he was asked to do a job he had no business doing. And now 35,000 people hate him. And that's not fair. Justice for Exumé. If you ask a fish to climb a tree, like what? Hey, there's Tyson Philpott. Go cover him one-on-one. Like, yeah. What? What are we doing?
He's really nice, though, honestly. Like, a really nice guy. I hesitate to say that about some people in professional sports, but he's referred to as Kerf in Ryderville. Kerf is a really nice dude. So he doesn't deserve a lot of this, but Tyson Philpott, my goodness, he was in his kitchen cooking and roasting. Yikes.
I think Rider Nation is going to start the hashtag TurfKerf.
Jeez. Well, I mean, it's almost as if taking a guy who basically, like, he wasn't a full-time starter in college with the Carabin. Like, he was a special teams guy even back then. And then at 32 years old, asking him to start his first ever game matched up one-on-one against one of the best receivers in the league. It's almost like that's a bad idea, gentlemen, and should have never happened.
And I saw a bunch of feedback. People are like, well, this is why we need to get rid of the ratio. These Canadians
can't play.
It's like the Riders started more Canadians than they had to. They didn't have to start a Canadian at corner. They could have started American. The issue was they literally had nobody. And I want to make it very clear. I think the Saskatchewan Rough Riders front office has done a great job this year. They're obviously 10-3, so in a great position to finish first in the West Division. And they did get hammered by a bunch of injuries. But they failed this week in putting a roster out on the field that can be competitive.
No, it's only one spot. Week.
It's a very tough spot. I'm not denying that. I'm making that clear. But they needed to do better than say, okay, this guy who has never, ever, ever been a boundary corner and has no business playing there at the CFL level is going to start against a potentially dominant receiver in Tyson Philpott. They set him up to fail, so it's not his fault for failing is my point.
I agree. I wouldn't necessarily call him a boundary corner because the Riders usually play left and right.
Fair.
But your point's well taken. And a bunch of those plays, to me at least, look like it was to the field, like Tyson Philpott running the go ball that I remember down the right side that Philpott had to go up and make a play on. But, you know, I think the interesting thing to me, fellas, is that Antoine Brooks Jr., the American, had started a game earlier in the year. You know, had one big, massive bust. Vernon Adams Jr. hit Damian Alford to get the Stamps back in that football game. I shouldn't even say back in, but regain a 2-touchdown lead after the Riders had went down in the third quarter relatively easily and scored. And then it's Kerfala Exumé that's in there, not Antoine Brooks Jr. Now, there were some other injuries in the game. So that, to me, is where I think potentially the error was made. It's easy to say in hindsight. I think there was some miscommunication that Roland Milligan talked about in the back end. It didn't seem like there were some flat out coverage busts, but Hodge, to your point, like I saw some of those comments about the ratio and I'm like, can people count? Like sometimes we get some ridiculous comments coming into the 620 CKRM post game show. And there wasn't any this week, But I saw some of the ratio stuff. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, oh, okay, by the way, on the flip side, Tyson Philpott is Canadian. Did no, they know that? Point. I don't think those people who made those comments knew that.
Well, and to your point, there is a history of counting problems in Saskatchewan. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Oh!
There is. Oh, it's true.
On that note, let's get to what we're discussing on the pod today, boys. Ryan Dinwiddie's emphatic, and I mean absolutely emphatic celebration after Toronto's last-second walk-off win over Edmonton.
Which three CFL teams we each think will miss the playoffs?
Mike O'Shea weighing in on player injuries.
MLSC striking a supposed marketing deal with the Buffalo Bills.
And CJ Rivas taking issue with his fine from the Banjo Bowl. But first,
we start on a somber note, fellas. Hamilton Tiger Cats general manager Ted Gavaya passed away on Friday morning at 55 years old after a battle with cancer. Hodge, you already wrote a memorial about the Burlington, Ontario native, and you have another one on the way. What can you tell us about the late Ted Gavaya?
Ted Gavaya was a great man. I mean, he really was. He's somebody who I never intended to become friends with and ultimately did. Our friendship did not really consist of talking about a lot of football, to be perfectly honest. But as anybody who knew Ted and was lucky enough to know Ted can tell you, and I've talked to a ton of them in the last 3 days, I've got an article coming out possibly Monday morning, at latest Tuesday. It's going to be 5,000 words just about of people's experiences with Ted and not just what he did in the CFL, what he accomplished at the U Sports level, CJFL, with Football Canada, helping grow the game on a national level, international level, what he meant to people who are coming up in the system and how he mentored people, how he had to take the long route to achieve success, but eventually did so, becoming a GM for the first time at the age of 54. I mean, he was a great dude. He had an unbelievable sense of humor, extremely affable, extremely likable. The first time I met him was the 2019 CFL Combine in Toronto, a combine I wasn't going to go to because Three Down Nation at the time had about three buttons and a piece of pocket lint for a travel budget. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to pay my own way if I go. And finally, I just decided, screw it, I'm paying my own way. And I went. And I met Ted at the refreshment table because I'm never a stranger to the refreshment table. And we got to talking. And the first time we chatted after that, he let me know that he took issue with something that I'd written about the Bombers scouting department. And I remember feeling a little like, oh, geez. And he let me know that that had caused a meeting to be held where some higher ups had some serious questions for the scouting department. And that was kind of the first time as a young, naive reporter, I realized, oh, wow, like what I write really affects people. And if I'm going to write something or if I'm going to say something, I have to be willing to stand by it 100%. Whether it's positive, whether it's negative, it just has to be fair and something that I can 100% put my name behind. And in that same conversation, Ted flipped like a pancake and he was jovial. And to be fair, he wasn't rude about it. He was just direct about it. And he was like, yeah, and if you're ever in Burlington, you can come out on my boat. And I remember my first thought was like, is he trying to figure out a way to dispose of my body? Like he wants to have me out on his boat. And anybody who knows Ted know he took a lot of pride in his boat that he had for years and years off the coast of Burlington, Lake Ontario. But no, that was just Ted. He wanted to be everybody's friend. He treated everybody with dignity, with respect. He could vent. He could get frustrated. But at the end of the day, he was a great person. He was a great football man. And my experiences with him are paltry compared to some of the people I've had the privilege of speaking with, whether it's Danny McManus, people like Jim Mullen, people who, you know, either worked super closely with him or have known him for the better part of, I mean, in some cases, two or even more than two decades. So it was a lousy day on Friday. But at the same time, for someone who I think flew under the radar as long as Ted did, and for someone who was as quietly competent as Ted was for so long, one of the nice things that has come out of a horrible situation, of course, terrible situation, is the fact that a lot of people who had no idea who Ted Gavaya was are getting the opportunity to celebrate him and learn about him. So if you want a silver lining, I think that's it. And I, for one, am going to miss Teddy. And I think I speak for just about everybody in the CFL or around the CFL, whether it's as members of the media, players, coaches, whoever. I think we're all going to miss Teddy. And we wish we'd had him for a lot longer, because I wrote this in my memorial and I think it's true. If Ted had remained healthy, I think he would have gone down as one of the best in Ticats history. I think he would have been right up there on that wall of honor with all those other legends, including Miles Grell, who was just put up there this year. So rest in peace, Teddy. We're going to miss you.
You said that beautifully, Hodge. And I think the important thing to remember all the time is that when you see championship teams and you see dynasties, there are often recognizable faces. The head coach, the general manager, you know, the star quarterback. But championship teams are built on a lot of people behind the scenes that do hard work, that are on the road all year long, that are finding talent. And when you look at the Winnipeg Blue Bombers and what they were able to accomplish over this last stretch of time, Ted Gavaya is as responsible for that, if not more, than anybody else. What he was able to do on the Canadian side, truly remarkable, building that team. And you can see his impact already with the Hamilton Tiger Cats. In just one off season, the way he's helped change the culture of that team, some of the pieces he's brought in. You watch Devin Varisuk running out there on defense as a starting middle linebacker as a rookie, and that's a guy that he took a shot on as the second overall pick. And some of the other rookies that are making plays as Canadians for them. That's Teddy and the type of impact that he had. I did not have the same personal relationship with him that you did, but I can tell you that every time we spoke at a combine or a Grey Cup, it was an incredible conversation. He was warm. He was welcoming. One of my favorite nights of my life was at a Grey Cup party in Regina, where I just sat in the corner with Teddy for about an hour, and we talked about his time as the UBC head coach. And he talked about the struggles of that program at that time and everything he had to go through to keep the T-Birds afloat so that I could enjoy them as a fan many years later. So he was a special, special individual, a guy who has impacted the game at every single level in this country and will be sorely missed.
My, let's say, dealings with Ted Gavaya go all the way back to the early 2000s, fellas, when he was with the McMaster Marauders, and I was a little pissant high school quarterback that for some reason he and Greg Marshall had an interest in recruiting. And I went to multiple McMaster high school football camps, and I remember, you know, the first few times being around Ted Gavaya, it was a much different relationship than what turned out to be from a professional standpoint. But I was like, this guy doesn't mess around. So I better be on my P's and Q's, or he's going to be on me in a hard coaching type of way. Now, I ultimately didn't end up playing for McMaster because I think if I have my timing right, Greg Marshall had left to coach the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and it just didn't feel like the same to me. So I ended up playing at Guelph. Everybody can have a drink. But that's the first time when I was connected with Ted Gavaya. Little did I know down the line that, you know, I would get to know him much better as a human being, as a man, as a professional, and as a person that was so passionate about Canadian football. But Hodge and JC, we've talked about this. I think, you know, one of the best ways for people to understand Ted Gavaya, for those that didn't know him, is the fact that he didn't seek out the spotlight. It wasn't something that he needed. Like, he truly loved the work. And some people might say, you know, to the detriment of other things in his life, but I just think that's how much he loved football. And anybody who was in his life, you know, in his family, close to him, partners, all that kind of stuff, knew that he was that dedicated to football. And what I liked most about Ted Gavaya, and I'm not saying other scouts don't do this, but that he respects Americans at any level, Canadians at any level, all the same. It didn't matter to Ted Gavaya. He was fierce and competitive, but also caring. And like from a legitimate standpoint, I hesitate to say that about a lot of people, but you know, we would have conversations that would have little to do with football, you know, especially about my family and my nephews and my nieces that I love so much. And I don't tell people, as you guys know, a lot of that stuff. But when somebody actually shows me that they care, and Ted was one of those people, you know, I'd talk about it with him. Of course, I'm joking around with him about my nephews and we'll see what they do in sports. And the one kid's a beast and is getting so big. And, you know, maybe he'll go on to play football, which is a whole other conversation. I don't even know if I'd want him to do that, but I'm not his parent. So we'll see what happens. Anyways, that I think, you know, can give people a sense of who Ted Gavaya was. And, you know, it was only after he passed away that I thought back to Hodge, you kind of alluded to it, that people knowing him for over two decades, I in a way was one of those people. Like, it weird to think of, and I didn't actually think about it until he was gone. And obviously, rest in peace to Ted. But that's just how connected he was with Canadian football. And that's how much he cared about Canadian football. Like, he was a head coach at the university level, the Canadian Junior Football League level, and a longtime personnel man and assistant general manager for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, won multiple Grey Cups, and was a key part of those Bombers teams that have gone to five straight Grey Cups. We'll see if they can get to a sixth one. That's a conversation for another day. But he never needed to be praised by outside people or have the cameras in his face or sought out the microphone. And I think that's probably the thing that I respected most about Ted. And that probably comes from my farming background, right? It's always about doing the work every day, being consistent, and then bearing the fruits of your labor. And I think that's ultimately, to me, who Ted Gavaya was.
I think that's well said, gentlemen. Ted is somebody who absolutely did the work. He did not play the political game. There's a lot of people who I think climb the ladder more quickly than they otherwise would by playing that game. The issue is, if you don't get there on merit and you get there on leveraging relationships, it's all that much harder to stay at the top of the ladder. And Ted is somebody who, Steve Milton wrote a great line in his column for the Tiger Cats website, which is Ted was very much someone who took the stairs, not the elevator. And the best part about being one of those people is that once you actually get to the top, the chances of you staying there are extremely high. Why? Because you've done all the work. You've earned every step. You can't get surprised by things you don't know how to handle. Why? Because you've had to handle them time and time again as you sling through the mud to try to get up to where it is you're going, right? If you take the elevator and you skip levels, that might happen. If you go the slow way, it's the hard way, it's not the glamorous way. Once you get there, you're ready to go. And I think that's why Ted has had so much success already as a GM. And that's one of the reasons why I think, honestly, and multiple people in work of the second article I'm doing have said that within the Tiger Cats organization, there are people kicking themselves because they're going like, why didn't we do this 5 years ago? Why didn't we do this 6 years ago? This man has lived in Burlington this whole time, and he's been to five Grey Cups in the last 5 years, and he's got three championships dating back to his time with the Toronto Argonauts. And then, of course, he's got three Yates Cups before that with the Greg Marshall, Jesse Lumsden, McMaster Marauders, as Dunk alluded to. So we're going to miss
Teddy. Might have
been
four.
I think Teddy was four in a row? Three, but yes, they went to four in a row. I'd have to double check that. But, one of the things that I'm going to strive to do as a young member of the media, and I had this conversation with many of my sources, is one of the things I'm going to hope to do, if I'm lucky enough, is spend the next 20, 30, 40 years ensuring that people never forget about Ted Gavaya. Obviously, there are scholarship programs. There are other things being planned to honor his legacy and everything that he was able to do. Because someone who, again, did the work and went around about their business the right way deserves a legacy, and he's going to get one. So I appreciate everybody who's offered kind words. If you haven't read my articles on Ted, if you haven't read Steve Milton's article on Ted or any others that are out there, please do. He's a great guy, and I think you can learn a lot from somebody like that. Whether you knew them personally or you can just read the great stories people have. And I've been lucky enough again that a lot of people have shared some really great stories about Ted with me. Ryan Dinwiddie let loose at the end of Toronto's 31-30 win over the Edmonton Elks this weekend, kicking the air wildly and chirping Edmonton's bench. He later told Three Down Nation contributor Griff Bourdignon that transpired. I was so nervous about saying Griff's name. I've completely bungled the rest of this.
He nailed it though.
I messed it all up. He later told Three Down Nation contributor Griff B what transpired had nothing to do with Elks head coach Mark Killam, but quote, a pretender that's not in our building anymore, close quote, and a coach he claims was chirping him all game. Because remember, the sidelines are on the same side of the field at BMO Field. He also added, quote, those guys can enjoy the offseason, close quote. JC, what did you make of Dinwiddie's antics?
Well, I can't say that I love them, right? And I'm more conservative when it comes to how I think that a head coach should... Okay.
What is wrong with you?
I found it very entertaining, but I'm trying to look at this from an objective, analytical head coach perspective, right? And I think when you're somebody who's in charge of a team, as much as it can fire your guys up to act like that at times, you also lose a certain amount of credibility when you're asking for discipline at the end of the game when you are the one who's potentially sparking a brawl. And we very nearly got some entanglement between the two coaches in this one because Kevin Mattal stepped in between them before Mark Killam could make his way fully over and make contact with Ryan Dinwiddie. Chirping happens in games, and I'm not defending the actions of the Edmonton Elks. We believe that this was Jordan Williams, the defensive tackle who the Argos cut earlier this year, and then Demetrius Maxey was the coach. He was with the Argos in 2024 as their defensive line coach, who were giving Dinwiddie the business all night. I'm not defending their actions, but that's to be expected between the whistles. After the whistles, you've got to comport yourself a little bit differently. And I didn't think this was a good look for Dinwiddie. I also didn't love his comment of those guys can enjoy the offseason because guess what? You're both 5-8. Like, you have the same record. The only reason you're not already in the same boat and in that enjoy the offseason mode is because you're lucky enough to play in the East Division. And so you still have life. These teams are very close. I thought that was unbecoming of Dinwiddie to make a comment like that, but he's authentic, if nothing else. And I think that's part of the reason why he has had success is because guys know that when he speaks, it's what he actually thinks.
JC, Ryan Dinwiddie is like Patrick Waugh right now because he can't hear you with his two Grey Cup rings stuck in his ears. This is more of what we need in the Canadian Football League. Are you kidding me? This guy pulling off a Tiger Woods-esque celebration and even taking it to another level? Like, this is entertainment at its greatest, and clearly it works for Dinwiddie. You alluded to it, JC, him being authentic. He has led his team to win two of the last three Grey Cups. Like, this was awesome. It will be the most talked about, what do we want to call it, altercation, celebration, definitely for the week, perhaps the entire season. That was epic stuff. I'm not condoning having fisticuffs or being on the verge of a brawl. So all that aside, instead of hiding your feelings or perhaps, you know, not being truthful, as I've alluded to in the past, the media, like that goes with a lot of people in professional sports. I love the authenticity for Ryan Dinwiddie. And I can understand why, JC, as you alluded to too, the players in the locker room would want to play for this guy. I'm not saying it's over and above anybody else in the league, but he shows you how much he wants to win. Right, and how much it means to him. Do you want to let some chirping get the best of you? I would think more times than not, no. But from an entertainment standpoint, and that's literally what professional sports are supposed to be, this was awesome. Give me more. Ryan Dinwiddie celebrating, kicking the air like he was Liam Hiralahu booting it through the uprights with no time on the clock.
Do we think Dinwiddie could have made that kick? He might have, with based on how flexible he was. That,
let's line him up and see.
I'll say this. I had most of that game tuned on my TV. I was simultaneously doing interviews with people for my upcoming TED article, because that's been my entire weekend. But at the 5-minute mark of the fourth quarter, I had to leave to go to the Manitoba Bisons game. They were hosting the Saskatchewan Huskies. By the way, 17-0 at halftime, came back, won the game 21-20. Unbelievable finish at Princess Auto Stadium. Arguably saving the Bison season, but I digress. I get to the stadium and I look at the 3-down group chat, and there's like 50 messages in there, and people are losing their mind about what did you think Ryan did, what he did? What did you think he did? That was crazy. And I'm sitting there, no one in the chat has just put, this is what he did. And so I'm walking from my car into the building, and the whole way my imagination is running wild. I'm like, what did he do? Did he punch someone? Did he attack? Like, what happened? And so I wouldn't say I was let down when I eventually saw what he did, which is just like in celebrate emphatically. It was fun. I don't think it was classy. I think that someone like Dinwiddie should probably act like he's been there before, because he has. He's literally won 2 Grey Cups and finished first in the East Division twice.
But why?
It was awesome. It was super entertaining. And honestly, I think between the fact that, yes, he is the most cut and dried interview in the CFL of anybody you can talk to on the record in this league, he is the person, and I can only speak for myself, though I do watch basically every media availability that is done around this country every single week, but I'll just speak for the people I've interviewed, which is at this point, I think every single head coach and GM multiple times, and then upwards of 100 players. He is the person who you can most take to the bank, that when you ask Ryan Dinwiddie a question, he's going to punch you with an answer, and it's going to be succinct, and it's going to be honest, and there is no filler. There is no word salad. It is, hey, Ryan, what happened to Ryan Hunter? He got hit by a car. He's talking to the Maple Leafs doctors. He might be out for the season, but we're not sure yet. And it's like, wow. That was a 10-second answer with every piece of information I needed, and it was very transparent. Whereas there are other coaches in the league, and we'll talk about this a little bit later in the show, where they're literally like, who is Ryan Hunter? I think we'd all know who Ryan Hunter is. Why are you asking me this? Next question. It's like, he's the most outstanding offensive lineman in the league. He starts at right tackle for you. Oh, that guy. Well, we'll worry about that another day. It's like, it's ridiculous. So I love that. The other thing that Ryan Dinwiddie's done, which I think he deserves a lot of credit for, maybe not so much this game with the 4 picks that Nick Arbuckle threw, but I digress, is from an entertainment standpoint, he's also done a great thing with quarterbacks, right? Whether it's McLeod Bethel Thompson, Nick Arbuckle, right? He has elevated guys who have been okay quarterbacks elsewhere and turn them into potential MOPs, right? Nick Arbuckle could, despite the 4 picks, I'm not defending this week's performance, he could reasonably finish first in the league in passing this year. He could reasonably finish first in passing touchdowns. McLeod Bethel Thompson accomplished both of those things under Ryan Dinwiddie. Like, this guy, between his ability to elevate quarterbacks, between some of the things he says, some of the things he does, he is A+ entertainment. And so for that side of it, especially as a member of the media, but also somebody who does watch this game as a fan every week, you gotta love it. You gotta love it. At least I certainly do.
I have a lot of respect for what Ryan Dinwiddie has accomplished, and do what works for you. But in terms of the authenticity debate, all I'm saying is there's a way to be authentic and to be fiery without necessarily crossing that line. I mean, everybody has to do it.
Come on, bro. The three of us have.
Oh, come. But hey, we do it too. Like, the three of us have similar conversations about the topics we do in the podcast when the recording isn't going, and we use, let's say, more colorful language. We say other things that maybe we wouldn't say when
you're supposed to keep that behind the curtain, dude.
Well, I'm not saying what you're saying, but we don't say it in this setting because it's more of a professional one. And I think that applies to this situation.
Like, but how's Ryan Dinwiddie crossing the line? You ask him a direct question, he gives you a direct answer.
I have no problem with what he said in this
postseason race, and he's out here kicking it like Liram Hirilahu hit the ball. Should he take it another step further and perhaps get in a physical altercation, which didn't happen, by the way? Probably not. But man, you can't have it both ways.
It didn't happen because his players had to prevent it. So what? Like,
you can't have it both ways, bro. You want an entertaining guy or you want somebody boring? What's your pick?
Well, I think Mark Killam is an authentic, entertaining, fiery guy, right? He showed that going after Ryan Dinwiddie. But in the press conference afterwards, he wouldn't speak about it, right? He knew that it wasn't the time to take pot shots, right? Like,
Mark Killam, with all due respect, you're in the middle of it. You don't have to take pot shots, but at least Ryan Dinwiddie helped us understand what was going on.
Good
point.
That's a fair point in terms of the post.
You want boring, bland, and stale. We got
it. I don't want boring, bland, and stale. That's why we invite you. Party pooper.
I don't want my head coaches instigating fights on the sideline.
He wasn't instigating a fight. He was being a showboat. Those are different things.
I would argue they are similar things.
No.
One leads to the other.
Not always. And by the way, while we're talking about ridiculous behavior, an article I wish we could write that I don't think we can, but would be fun to write, is all 9 CFL coaches ranked based on how much you would not want to fight them, right? Who would be the hardest to fight in a physical altercation? Because I had that thought. I was like, man, if Mark Killam's not a big, big man, but I would not want him coming up to me looking for a fight. And then my imagination started rolling and I'm like, yeah, what would the CFL head coach fight power rankings be? Like, Killam is a strength and conditioning background. Mm. I don't want any piece of that. But it's interesting to think about.
Are there staffs involved? Like, is this sort of like
an anchorman
fight
situation?
Scene?
JC, you're not allowed to talk about anything that's fun, okay? You want boring. That's what you could talk about.
I'm just saying, does Dinwiddie have, like, Mikey Donovan behind him? With,
you mean Mickey Donovan. Mickey, not Mikey?
Mickey Donovan.
Who the heck
Donovan,
is Mikey Ivan. Donovan? Some boxing trainer?
He could be. I mean, Mickey Donovan's a big dude. That's what I'm trying to get at here.
Isn't right? that the guy from Rocky?
Mikey Donovan? I've seen Rocky once. It was like 15 years ago. I didn't think it was that good, but I don't know. Maybe that's sacrilege. I know it's a very popular sport.
We've gone off the wall here.
We have. Let's go to the next segment.
Oh, JC, we went to entertaining and you wanted to stay boring, okay?
Boring, JC.
You go eat your spaghetti and meatballs.
Instead of listen overtime to your East Coast in the future, let's get each head coach, we'll put them at the 55-yard line, and it'll be a fight to the death to determine the winner of the game. Is that better? Is that what you
That's
want?
That's how we should decide the Grey Cup, maybe. Honestly.
There's nothing wrong with a little passion, fellas. This was great. Ryan Dinwiddie, give us more. Inject it into my veins.
With 6 weeks left in the CFL regular season schedule, it's clear that three teams, the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, who have formally clinched, the Calgary Stampeders, and Hamilton Tiger Cats, are going to the playoffs. Beyond that, things are clear as mud. If you had to make a prediction right now, who would earn the final three spots in the playoffs and which seeds would they be in the league's two respective divisions?
Well, I think there are two teams that we can eliminate right off the bat, even if they have not actually formally been eliminated from the playoff race. The Ottawa Redblacks, with their loss this week, I just think there's too much ground for them to make up in the East Division race. And then I think the Edmonton Elks, as much as I think they are peaking at the right time and they're showing some great things, because they are currently in that fifth slot in the West, I think it's going to be too big of a mountain for them to climb as well. So from the remaining teams, who makes it? I think The Montreal Alouettes have shown that they still have the talent as long as they get the quarterback play. Davis Alexander is going to be back here at some point. We don't know when, but McLeod Bethel-Thompson played better in this game. I think they're a lock to make the playoffs. And then I think the Toronto Argonauts, with the way that they have blossomed as this season has gone on and shown that fire from their head coach, I think that they can prevent a crossover spot. I really do. I think they are going to make a push down the stretch. On the other side, in the West Division, when they're battling for that spot or to try and get into the crossover, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers are slipping right now. The BC Lions had a better week. But when I look at their schedules, I just have a tough time with seeing how the BC Lions are going to make the playoffs, because they have two games remaining against the Calgary Stampeders, and they've got one game against the Saskatchewan Roughriders left on their schedule. And the Roughriders, as much as they hope that they'll have everything locked up at that stage and won't need to play all their starters because of their loss this week, they could very much be still in a battle for first place in the West with the Stamps at that point. So I don't think it's a given that that game is going to mean nothing. The Lions have slipped up too much. I think they're going to struggle a little bit against that Stamps defense. And I think Vernon Adams Jr. is going to come into those games fired up against a questionable BC defense. I can see them stubbing their toe enough to be the team that misses the postseason.
I'll start in the East. It seems like the Hamilton Tiger Cats are going to lock that top spot up and host the Eastern Final, as some people like to call it. If Davis Alexander is healthy, I think it's a wrap. The Montreal Alouettes will be the second seed in the East. Then we have to look at the West, okay? Because the Saskatchewan Roughriders getting whooped in their own building going into the bye week creates a much different dynamic. If the Riders, and I don't want to say simply, but put away the Alouettes like they were supposed to and enjoy the bye week, they can cruise to that top spot. But that's up in the air now. Because if Calgary's tied with them at the end of the year, the Stamps has a tiebreaker, as we all know. So I think those two teams will make the playoffs, as Hodge said, but the seeding is still up in the air. To be quite honest, fellas, I got some major questions about the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. And I don't necessarily know, and I'm happy to be proven wrong, that this team is a lock to make the playoffs. You know, I look at the Toronto Argonauts. If Chad Kelly doesn't even play with what Nick Arbuckle has done and Jared Don't Call Me Dougie Daggy was able to do at the end of the game there, that Ryan Dinwiddie, I think, is going to find a way to scrap and claw and get the defending champs in there to see if they can have a real defense of their Grey Cup title in the playoffs. So I guess what that boils down to is JC breaking down the BC Lions and then the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, if the Argos are indeed going to be that third team in the East. I still think that's up in the air, right? There's definitely some games down the stretch that are going to decide that. Ottawa would have to run the table for the most part to have a real chance to get in. I think Edmonton is probably in a similar situation. And looking at the Riders have a relatively easy schedule, which is why I think they'll probably be in top spot in the West. Calgary's too. Then it's between BC or Winnipeg. And I think BC, for me right now, especially with Nathan Rourke healthy at quarterback, has more juice than Winnipeg. Hodge, what say you about the Bombers?
I mean, I think Zach Kolaris will be back. And I suspect that it could be in the relatively near future. And that is obviously a huge key for this team. Chris Streveler did not play well enough for this team to win. And I think the fact that Mike O'Shea made it very clear when speaking to the media after that game in Steeltown that he did not for a second consider putting Terry Wilson in under center. I mean, it would seem it doesn't really matter who else the Bombers have on the roster. I will point out that the entire thing that started, right, that was the catalyst for this Winnipeg five straight Grey Cup appearance was trading for a quarterback at the end of the year because Chris Streveler was not good enough. That is a fact that is not arguable. The Bombers made a deal for Zach Kolaris literally minutes before the trade deadline because Chris Streveler was losing games as a starter. I've said it on the show before. And we've said it even recently. Chris Traveler is a great football player. He is not a great quarterback. And he did some nice things late in that game when the Tiger Cats had kind of called off the dogs, but he was terrible in that first half. There's no other word for it. Like the first interception, I think you give more of the credit to Jamal Peters, but the second interception, it's like Nick Dembski is just, he ran a hook into a defender waiting there in man, was not remotely open, and Chris Traveler just threw it to Deshaun Amos anyway. And it's like, what are you doing? And what has killed this Bombers team is takeaways. They have more, or giveaways, rather. They have more giveaways than any other team in the CFL. What's killed the Lions is they have the second most, right? So I think what is going to decide this third or fourth playoff spot in the West, if there is a fourth playoff spot in the West, because I'm not convinced there will be, but if there is, it's going to be the team that learns how to protect the ball, because I like Winnipeg's defense a lot more than BC's defense. I actually think Winnipeg's defense has been underrated all season long. They've started to get that secondary playing well. Demario Houston, I thought, looked very good. They're healthy on that side of the ball, more or less, and they could even get some pieces back at the end of the year. Guys like Jamal Parker have been out. I like it a lot more than BC's defense. But offensively, you just can't turn the ball over like that and expect to win games. Well, actually, I have to retract that. The Argonauts lost the turnover battle 6-1 and beat Edmonton. So maybe you can, but you can't take that to the bank. So if pushed to make a prediction, I will echo what I think both of you gentlemen have said, which is at this point in time, though it's not impossible for Ottawa and Edmonton to make the playoffs, I will predict that they will both miss. I predict that Saskatchewan and Calgary will be 1-2 in the West. I'm not sure Calgary doesn't finish first, but I'll give the Riders the lead right now. I think Hamilton and Montreal get the top two seeds in the East. And I will say the Winnipeg Blue Bombers finish fourth in the West Division and crossover for the last playoff spot in the East, knocking out the Toronto Argonauts. But they've got to be better than they were in Steeltown on the offensive side of the ball. Simply not good enough. If you give the ball away, you can kiss any chance of playing your Grey Cup at home goodbye.
Can we just stop one thing, fellas? Because I don't want to go on a soapbox here, but like too often in sports, and especially in football, because that's what we're talking about, we hear about guys who are like true pros and put in the work. But ultimately, and I'm talking about Chris Traveler, you have to perform on the field. Like Mike O'Shea is potentially going to lose a playoff spot because he's just tied at the hip with Chris Traveler no matter what, essentially, as the Bombers' backup quarterback. And we hear it about other guys all the time. And, you know, it got me to thinking, like, if everybody did the hard work, that would mean that everybody wins, which is not possible. So I'm not saying don't do the hard work, but at some point, you have to perform consistently on the field. And like, I'm a big Chris Traveler guy. He's ultra athletic. I like what he can do for you in short yardage. But this guy looked better as a passer in the NFL for a reason, fellas, because the field is smaller. Multiple other factors as well, but I think that was the main one. Since he's come back to the Canadian Football League, like, where would you rank him among the backup quarterbacks in the CFL? And I like the guy by all accounts from what I've heard from behind the scenes and the rest, but like the Bombers could miss the playoffs because Mike O'Shea likes to hang on to these kinds of veteran guys for too long, but just because they're his guy. And at some point, I'm like, I just don't get it. What am I not seeing with this guy? And you might lose your playoff spot because of it as a team that's gone to five straight Grey Cups.
Well, it's a valid...
Go ahead, JC.
Yeah, it's a valid point, Dunk, right? And I think the question that you have to ask yourself if you're a Bombers fan is, okay, is there another quarterback out there that I can acquire at this stage that can come in and help me? I don't know that there is, right? You've sort of made your bed. Now you have to lie in it.
My point is stuck to Traveler, right? Like you didn't look at the quarterback market, the backups of the offseason when like Cody Fajardo, McLeod Bethel-Thompson, potentially Jake Mayer were all out there. I think guys around the league, personnel people and coaches would probably say, hey, yeah, those are better quarterbacks than Chris Traveler. The Bombers are like, no, We're good. And I get it. Well, I'm not saying he's a bad dude. I'm not saying he doesn't put the work in. I'm not saying there's not some potential upside there. But Chris Traveller, essentially, at this point in his career, is who he is.
Yeah, well, I don't have in my notes what his record was in 2018, like his very first year in the CFL. But Straveler went 3-5 over 8 straight starts in 2019, leading up to the Zach Collaros trade. Zach started the last game of the regular season, and there's a reason he started in the playoffs, despite at that point having like a matter of days in the offense. And it's because Zach Collaros, with days in the offense, was better than a well-prepared Chris Straveler. And we know Mike O'Shea believed that, because if he didn't, Chris Straveler would have started those games in the playoffs. And then Chris Straveler, credit to him, goes to the NFL. He won his only start last year, and he was actually 2-0 as a starter heading into this game. So since 2019, he is now a 500 quarterback, which is not awful. 500 is average, right? But when you look at the performance, right? I mean, I saw it pointed out, and this was a true fact until, fortunately for the Bombers, Nick Arbuckle threw 4 picks and now has this dubious distinction. But for a brief time after this Argos Bombers Ticats game, Winnipeg had the 2 quarterbacks in the league with the most picks. Zach Collaros with 13, Chris Straveler with 10. And now on his career, Chris Straveler has 26 touchdowns and 30 picks. For context, as a CFL rookie in 2018, he had 11 touchdowns and 5 picks, which means he literally played his best football statistically as a rookie. He has gotten worse as a passer statistically, and his rushing average has also dropped off over that time as he's just taken more hits and teams know what to take away from him. So,
and he's had injuries too.
And he's had injuries. He did a remarkable job coming back from the ACL. I'll give him 100% credit for that. But no, Chris Straveler, not good enough. And the Bombers, all of their eggs are in the Zach Collaros basket. It should be noted, they've got the rights to Taylor Elgersma. I'm sure the Bombers would love to have him under contract, but the thought that this kid, who is only 1 year removed from U Sports, is going to come in and lead you to a Grey Cup, I think is a pipe dream. I think Taylor Elgersma could be a Grey Cup quarterback someday, but I don't think he's the silver bullet you're looking for in 2025. I think you need a veteran, and that has to be Zach Collaros, because I don't think there's anybody else available.
My point is more about the personnel decision. It's nothing against Chris Traveller. And yes, the Saskatchewan Roughriders are a great example, okay? Last year, Shea Patterson started a number of games for the team, was essentially average. And the Riders are like, we believe we can get better at quarterback. So they go out and trade for Jake Mayer, sign him to a 1-year contract extension, and say a nice goodbye to Shea Patterson, who, you know, did eventually end up in Winnipeg. I would love to understand, know what happened there, but that's my point. Is like the Riders were like, okay, you're pretty good, but we think that we can do better. And there were other quarterbacks out there on the market. And Hodge, you know, to your point about his numbers coming down, especially his rushing totals, like he's had two major injuries?
He had in 2019, he actually played the postseason, I believe, the official injury. You'd have to Google it because I'm going off the top of my head for confirmation, but it was some form of a broken foot. And then and he played it with it shot up like crazy. And then he obviously tore his ACL in the Banjo Bowl in 2024 and was able to recover and return for this season. So, yes, has had 2 major injuries that I'm aware of off the top of my head.
And mad respect to the guy. I like his vibe, the whole fur coat thing, Winnipeg Grey Cup in 2019. Like, the full deal was great. So I'm just looking at it from a personnel standpoint and wanting to be better. And ultimately, all the teams around the Canadian Football League know that you have to have at least 2 competent quarterbacks to have a chance to make the playoffs.
I'll add 2 things to this conversation before we move on. First of all, I think the thing that needs to be said, the quiet part that nobody really seems to be willing to talk about at this point, is as bad as Chris Straveler has been when he's starting games, Zach Collaros isn't playing very good this season, right? And he hasn't for, I would argue, 2+ years now. He's not the same quarterback he once was when he was winning MOPs. And I think that while there is a significant difference between Collaros and Straveler, Collaros is not in the top half of quarterbacks in the CFL right now. And that needs to be stated when we're having this discussion, because many of the same points that you've raised, Dunk, about getting better at the quarterback position and assessing your guys can also be applied to Zach, in the sense that the Bombers should have been doing a better job preparing for the eventual retirement of a 37-year-old and getting better at that position overall. But on the flip side, and the reason why I picked the Bombers to make the playoffs over the BC Lions is the fact that they currently have the season series, right? So if these two teams are tied, it will go to the Bombers. And part of the reason why they have the season series, full credit to Chris Streveler, is because he played an amazing game at the beginning of the year against the BC Lions and kicked their butts. And so that could potentially be the factor that lifts Winnipeg into the playoffs over their rival. There's a lot of nuance to this conversation, but when we're talking about Streveler and Zach and all the troubles in Winnipeg, you can't ignore the fact that that will be a key piece to their playoff run.
One other part that has to be mentioned is the fact that both Kolaris and Streveler are working with the first-year offensive coordinator in Jason Hogan, who Brady Oliveira, you know, felt some type of way about after the Labor Day Classic when the Bombers lost and went and had a conversation with. Now, he knows him very well from being his running backs coach, but I think that's another part to this equation, is that, yes, Kolaris and Streveler need to take better care of the football, but there's also somebody who's new in that offensive coordinator role, much different from Buck Pierce calling plays and doing everything that he does in the meetings, going to a guy, with all due respect, who's doing it for the first time.
Agreed. I will point out, though, because I do think JC is bang on. 2023, Zach Kolaris, 33 touchdowns, 15 picks. 2024, 17 touchdowns, 15 picks. So same number of interceptions, half the touchdowns. This year, 14 touchdowns, 13 picks. So Zach has not been good enough this year. I do believe that, yes, the scheme is part of those challenges, but he wasn't lighting it up last year. And I'll throw this out because I know we need to move on. Right now, Zach Kolaris is under contract for 2026. If I'm the Bombers, I'm happy to have Zach back for 2026, but there is a 0% chance that he is worth that same $500,000 to $600,000 contract in hard money that he's received the last few years. To me, he is where Bo Levi Mitchell was a few years ago, where it was like, we're happy to bring you back, but it's going to be a $250,000 hard deal with $150,000 of play time, right? If you play at an MOP level, you can make $400,000, but there's no way that going into week one, we can pay you $500,000 to $600,000 guaranteed if this is the production we're getting. It just doesn't make sense.
But if you're Kolaris on his side, you say the Bombers, okay, who else are you going to go get?
I mean, at this rate, Nick Arbuckle for $250,000 or Taylor Elgersma, or like, I'm not saying that there's super good options, but if you look at the statistics, Nick Arbuckle has been a much more productive quarterback in 2025 than Zach Kolaris.
Fair. Those are just statistics. So I'm saying part of the discussion I'm sure we'll have in the offseason. Hodge, Blue Bombers head coach, speaking of Winnipeg, Mike O'Shea told Derek Taylor on 680 CJOB he doesn't think any injury information should be made available to fans or the media, calling it, quote, personal, close quote. The comment was made as he expressed frustration at the speculation surrounding Zach Kolaris, who was unable to play in Week 15 due to a head injury. Do you think what O'Shea said was fair?
No, it was ridiculous. Absolutely preposterous. I appreciate that Mike O'Shea is frustrated by the speculation about Zach, and that's fine. He's allowed to feel that way. But the entire, like the way to get rid of speculation is transparency. If you are completely opaque about what is going on in your building, members of the media, fans, anybody who has a vested interest in the CFL has no choice but to speculate. And we saw it on the TSN panel with them speculating it was a head injury. They labeled it a speculation, which is in my opinion, good journalism. You have to differentiate between when you are speculating and when you are reporting a fact. They did the right thing. And lo and behold, it was a head injury. And listen, Mike O'Shea did a really interesting thing here where he kept sliding the word personal. This is personal injury information. This is I'm sorry. The word personal appears on injury reports because there are times where the reason a player is absent from practice or a game is personal. And that's a code word from the team to the media and the public at large that this is the player's private information. And that can mean a lot of things. Some examples, it can mean this player is having a baby and he's probably going to be happy to talk about it when he returns to practice, but we're not sharing that information on his behalf unless he wants it shared. It could mean this player is at home tending to a parent who is ill and dying. And if they want to reveal that information when they get back to practice, they can, but we're not going to announce it on their behalf. It could mean this is a player who's undergoing an addiction battle and they've needed to go to rehab, and it's not anyone's business that they're struggling with whatever addiction they're dealing with, and they'll be back when their crisis is over. And if they want to talk about it at that point, they can. It's their choice, but don't pry, right? Those are all things that have happened in this league, and there are more examples of what personal can mean. Personal is personal, and I respect that. I would never report a story about somebody checking into rehab or somebody's, you know, wife having a tragic accident and dying unless I had the person's permission. I would be within my rights to do it as a reporter, but it would make me a jerk is what it would make me. And I don't want to do that. Having a swollen ankle that's going to keep you out for 2 weeks is not personal information. You're a professional athlete and everybody in the stadium saw you walk off hobbling on your ankle. And Mike O'Shea made it very clear. I don't think that, you know, the betting public or fans deserve this information. Well, Mike O'Shea, with the exception of 1 year between his playing career and his coaching career, has made his living, and a good one, in the Canadian Football League at the expense of fans and bettors who have indirectly or very directly paid his salary. So if Mike O'Shea doesn't believe that the people who pay his salary deserve basic, not personal, but basic injury information, then I think he's completely out to lunch. There is no reason why you shouldn't be able to say, yeah, he tweaked a hamstring. We don't think he'll be able to go this week. We're hopeful he'll be back the week after, because that's what a lot of coaches do, and they have a lot of success with their teams as well. So no, this I thought was a tone-deaf statement from Mike O'Shea, and it bothered me a lot.
I agree with you, Hodge. If somebody breaks their arm or blows their ACL, that's not private information. Right, there is no harm that can come to the player for having that revealed to the public, and it only helps engage with your community and your fans, the people who, like you said, are paying their hard-earned dollars to support this team and pay not just the coaches but the players' salaries as well. I think the other element here, and part of why this was such a sensitive topic with Zach, is people don't trust the transparency within the Bombers organization when it comes to injuries. And when you are forced to report injury information, it makes you accountable to people and protects the players, right? We went through decades and decades of this information being closely guarded secrets. And quite frankly, a lot of players were mistreated. They had serious injuries that they shouldn't have been playing with, that were hidden or shot full of painkillers or done whatever in order to get them on the field. Again, there was never a public record of it, right? Here, if somebody suffers a head injury, well, that needs to be stated publicly so that everyone is looking and asking the right questions to ensure that the protocols are being adhered to. And unfortunately, the reality is when Zach Collaros was out with a neck injury, and I'm not saying that the Bombers were lying about this, but because they are so opaque, people did not trust that as legitimate information, and they assumed of their own accord that it was his head. And that manifested in a great deal of concern for a player that means a lot to a lot of people. If you are clearer with your injury information, if you are open with the public, if you show that you are always going to put the players first and you're not going to cover that up, then people will trust you. But if you're opaque with it, there is always going to be skepticism about how you are handling these situations.
There is so much to say on this topic, fellas, and it needs to be stated. I have a lot of respect for Mike O'Shea. And I think we all do, right?
Absolutely.
We would all agree on that.
Hall of Fame player and Hall of Fame coach. Rarified air. 1,000%.
It is very clear that he's from a different era. Because, you know, I find it quite disrespectful, fellas, that on a number of topics with Mike O'Shea, it is almost like you are not entitled to your own opinion. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's disrespectful. There are so many other words that I could use that are disrespectful to describe it. But I just can't understand it from my man who is so careful with his words that he knows that he's been in the world of professional, an emphasis on the word professional here, okay, on a number of fronts, professional football. You get paid to play formally and now coach the game, okay? Paid in the public eye. You've put yourself in the public eye partly because of how great of a coach you are, but also when you make that decision to play professional football or coach professional football. So if you don't want people having respectful opinions about you and the way you go about your injury information or whatever it is about your football team, then you need to go into a new career. Because I have found it time and time, and this is a guy that played at the same alma mater as me at the University of Guelph, was a great player there. Sorry.
What position?
He was one of the
best
players ever to play for the Griffins. And I'm not just saying that because I played there. Like, that's an actual fact. And I know people who know him very well. And I can remember, you know, the speech that he gave to us before a homecoming game. And then we went out there and beat Western. Like, he is definitely a leader of men. But just the more I read these comments and hear them and then think about them over the years, fellas, I just start to think it's disrespectful. Like, it's almost as if nobody else can have an opinion but Mike O'Shea on his football team. And I'm like, for real? Like, you have a consistently sold-out stadium of diehard blue and gold fans, and you can't even give, essentially, those are the people that pay your salary, an injury update on your franchise quarterback? Like, it has to come out in a forced way, as Hodge alluded to in the injury report, that it's a head injury? Like, just say it. I can't understand this stuff. So I'm sure Mike O'Shea has his reasons. And there must have been some point along the line where he was burned at least once or more times by the media. So I'm not even saying this from a media standpoint. I'm just talking about sheer respect. That there should be respect for other people to have an opinion about whatever it happens to be. And that, to me, has become a trend now, sadly, with Mike O'Shea. And I've bitten my tongue multiple times. But it's like when you start saying this stuff, it's like you're potentially impacting increased revenue in the Canadian Football League, especially when you have been the team that has gone to 5 straight Grey Cups and betting has become more and more a part of the league's revenue. Like, we see it everywhere, fellas. CFL.ca has betting sponsors all over it the last number of years, right? Every commercial set on TSN, let alone during the games, has a betting sponsorship. Like, the absolute bare minimum that you need to do to satisfy that area of potential upside and revenue growth is just give a simple update. We're not asking you to reveal every single detail. And imagine if we ever poked and prodded him, Hodge, I can imagine you trying to do this. about what went down in that game earlier in Toronto, where Zach Collaros played a half and they didn't come back in? There's no way he would give out those details. Now, I'm not saying he should, but we're just asking for some basic information. And not even us, fellas, because I don't even care about it anymore from a media standpoint. I think it's just basic respect to your fans at the end of the day. That's it.
Yeah. It's very hypocritical to say, yeah, I want to be paid good money as a head coach, but yeah, we don't, you know, you guys shouldn't be taking money from that revenue stream, which in fairness to Mike O'Shea is not exactly what he said, but I think it's fair to say he implied it.
And then it's like, also I want to be paid good money as a head coach, but like, yeah. I'm going to follow the rules that I believe I should follow.
And also, yeah, I really appreciate these 33,000 people showing up and buying gear and buying beer and yelling as loudly as they can to help us win games. But also, like, they don't really deserve answers about what's going on in this building. Like, they don't really deserve that. Like, just show up on game day and be cool. It's like, that's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, the corporate owner of the Toronto Argonauts, unveiled a new partnership with the Buffalo Bills that they've termed the first of its kind. The Argos and Bills will co-host kids camps, co-brand merchandise, and the Bills will hold authorized watch parties at a downtown Toronto sports bar owned by MLSC. Should CFL fans be concerned about this partnership?
Depends who you ask, fellas. Okay. Pose that question to Mr. Keith Pelly. He'll tell you, no. There's nothing to see here but some kids' football camps and some co-branded merchandise. Like, who out there is craving a t-shirt with an Argos and a Bills logo on it? Okay. There are just so many questions about this. You know, for one, Tracy McGrady. While we're on the topic of respect, you show up to an event in Toronto, you know, a place that you admittedly left and didn't ever really want to come back to, but you see a chance to make some money. So you come, you keep your sunglasses on, and you don't say a word. And your boy, Vince Carter, makes a joke about it and calls you out. But as a minority stakeholder in the Buffalo Bills, oh, there's a partnership with MLSC, one of the biggest sports entities in the world, and I'm going to make some money in it, and my shares in the Buffalo Bills are going to go up. Yeah, I'll show up. Like, you know, so much of this just reeks, fellas. I'm telling you, reeks, man. Because there are actually some people out there who are buying what MLSC, and this is mainly MLSC, is trying to sell here, okay? You talk to some smart people who've been around multiple levels of professional football for a long time to understand what's going on here. Okay, fellas, I'm going to ask you a couple simple questions. Did Ted Rogers want to get an NFL team?
Of course.
In Toronto?
Yes.
What else is left for Ed Rogers, you know, all due respect, I don't know about all of his business dealings, to do in his lifetime in terms of what his father would have wanted?
An NFL team. Though I think you should explain for the uninitiated who Ted Rogers is and why you're talking about
it. Well, Ted Rogers is the father of the vaunted Rogers conglomerate, I suppose we could call it.
Right. And how does Ed Rogers fit into MLSE?
Well, Ed Rogers is Ted's son, and yep. Ed Rogers now controls 75% of MLSE, one of, if not the biggest sports entity in the world.
We're talking Maple Leafs, we're talking Raptors, we're talking Toronto FC,
and Argos, Concerts, Scotiabank Arena.
And not under the MLSE banner, but what else does Ed Rogers own personally?
Well, I don't know if it's personally, but the Rogers family. Or at least
through the Rogers Corporation.
Yes. He owns the Rogers Center and the Toronto Blue Jays. He loves him some sports. So I'm just like, okay, what is going on here? Because this partnership can't just be for some kids' camps in Toronto. And I do think, actually, that there is some potential upside here for the Bills, even though it is small. You know, continuing to grow their brand in Toronto, be boots on the ground. That part makes sense to me. But when you have people out here talking about, oh, maybe in the new stadium, there'll be a section for Toronto Argonauts season ticket holders. I'm like, what are we talking about? Fellas, this is going to be informed speculation. But from people that I've talked to, if you look at the NFL, it's an old boys club, okay? The other NFL owners have to vote you in if you are going to get a team. Now, Ted Rogers has tried it, you know, another way in the past. It seemed like there was an opportunity when the Bills were owned by the late Ralph Wilson that that team could be had. That didn't happen. But if you're the Rogers family now, you're like, hey, okay, there's an opportunity where we could build some relationships, shake some hands, potentially show what we can do in our market to the benefit of the Buffalo Bills. And perhaps down the line, and again, this is speculation, there's a minority ownership in the Bills available. Or way, way down the line, I'm not saying this is in the near future, but if the NFL expands or there's a relocation, perhaps you get a chance at an NFL team, but it's about relationships. Doug Flutie got asked flatly, like, what would happen if an NFL team came to Toronto? And bless Doug, because he calls it like he sees it. He's like, you know, that would essentially not be good for the Toronto Argonauts, to paraphrase and put it lightly. So to me, that's what's going on sort of in the background here, because there's nothing else that really makes sense. Is it potentially great for the kids? Yes. You know, you've got the Buffalo Bills sponsoring the Metro Bowl, which is the high school football championship, or the biggest high school football championship game in the GTA, probably the biggest one in Ontario. So I think there's going to be some benefits at the grassroots level for the kids with the Bills integrating here. And some of that marketing could potentially rub off on the Argos, but it just seems like a weird fit to me, guys. Like, they're having a Buffalo Bills themed game at an Argos home game. And CFL fans are supposed to be like, yeah, we're okay with this. Now, I'm not saying that you need to batten down the hatches and start being worried right now. But if you look at the larger picture here, and then even go back to some things like in recent history, right? There was a well-respected report, I believe it was by the Globe and Mail, in and around the pandemic, about the Rogers family potentially, you know, I think, selling some land to the city where the Rogers Center now sits, demoing that building. It would become real estate at that time. This was a plan. And then they wanted to build a baseball stadium and a potential NFL stadium out on the lakefront somewhere. So, like, look at the history here with the Rogers family. You can go back to when the Bills played regular season games in Toronto. Was it a success? No. But that doesn't mean that the family's thought process on an NFL team has changed. I think now they're playing the long game, and perhaps a smarter game, with Keith Pelley there, who's, by all accounts, been renowned for what he's done on the DP World Tour and really grew up in the GTA area and talked about his love for football. You don't think there's anything else he would like to do that help the Rogers family bring an NFL team here? They're not going to tell you this outwardly, and I get that. And again, this is informed speculation. But you start talking to people and connect some of the dots, and it starts to become like the only thing that makes some sort of sense in this partnership.
By the way, thank you for saying GTA area. The same people who say Yak Yards, thank you. GTA area. A lot of people say that. I heard it multiple times at the press conference. And credit to you, Justin. You did a great job asking real questions and doing real reporting. You got a great quote from Keith Pelley about why the Toronto Argonauts are playing three extra road games last year. Thank you for holding his feet to the fire on that. Listen, yes, I'm sure Ed Rogers would love an NFL team in Toronto. Why do I know that? Well, because earlier this year, he told Toronto Life that he would love for there to be an NFL team in Toronto. Now, he didn't explicitly state he wanted to own that team, but this guy, who's got arguably the most impressive sports portfolio in the world, I'm sure would love to get an NFL team, right? Who wouldn't? While we're at it, I'd love to own an NFL team too. My expansion bid starts at $8, $9 if the commission from this podcast comes in, okay? But I think that this could be a positive thing for the Toronto Argonauts. First off, the Buffalo Bills care to be attached to MLSE and the Argonauts brand. That alone proves that someone cares about the Argonauts, right? The perception in and around this country, specifically in the GTA especially, is that
nobody cares. But is it the Argos or MLSE? I think it's more MLSE.
It is more MLSE, but MLSE and Toronto are largely one and the same. And the branded merch that they're selling together isn't MLSE Buffalo Bills gear. It is Argos Buffalo Bills gear. I agree that, you know, the kids stuff is all good. We all want kids to get more opportunities, kids camps and stuff. I also agree, though, that this isn't really about the kids camps, and it's not really about the watch parties at a downtown sports bar where the nachos are, I'd say, a 7 out of 10. I had them this summer. What this is about, I agree, is the possibility of potentially growing this relationship so that MLSE owns a piece of the Buffalo Bills in the future, or even gets their own NFL team. That's speculation on my part, but I believe that that would make all the sense in the world. Here's the thing. I think the short timeline for the NFL in Toronto would be 10 years, which means, okay, the Toronto Argonauts are the redheaded stepchild of the MLSE portfolio. They are the 9th out of 9 CFL teams when it comes to attendance, have been every year since 2013, and I believe that would stretch longer if the Hamilton Tiger Cats that year weren't playing at a Guelph while the construction was finished on Hamilton Stadium, okay? So right now in Toronto, you've got a team that does not have as much fan support as the other teams across the Canadian Football League, and you potentially have 10 years of the Buffalo Bills saying, hey, listen, we are Toronto's NFL team, but there is a CFL team in town and you guys should check it out. And I've spoken with people in BC who have laid out, well, this is the type of partnership we have. It's not as formalized as this one, but the BC Lions have a partnership with the Seattle Seahawks where the Seahawks will send their Canadian season ticket holders promos and information about the BC Lions tickets and opportunities to do things there. And they've collaborated on kids camps. They've collaborated on high school football games, specialized games. So this type of partnership that a lot of people who I would label alarmists are panicking about has already existed on the other side of the country. And I would say based on what Amar Doman's been able to grow there in the last 4 years has borne some fruit. So I'm not saying that the Argonauts are going to be selling out in 2 years as a result of this partnership. I'm not saying that everybody who's walking down Dundas Street is going to be wearing a Buffalo Bills, Toronto Argonauts t-shirt, but wouldn't it be cool if you saw some real advertisements in downtown Toronto where you've got Josh Allen on one side of the poster and you've got Chad Kelly on the other side of the poster. And it's like, hey, Toronto, here's your CFL team, here's your NFL team. Support both, right? Here's your summer, early fall team. Here's your, you know, mid-fall to win, you know, winter team, right? The Buffalo Bills have a $2.2 billion stadium opening next year. They want to fill that sucker for the next 50 years. They care a tremendous amount about the Toronto market. And here's the other thing that I think is worth talking about. The last thing the Buffalo Bills want, a team that, according to their own COO, has a season ticket base that's 10 to 15% in Canada, is a Canadian NFL team. So the more and more that Toronto and the GTA area cheers for the Buffalo Bills, loves the Buffalo Bills, considers the Buffalo Bills their team, I think if anything, that just makes it less likely that the NFL ever comes to Toronto. Because how, after spending all this time and money and resources and energy convincing the GTA that the Buffalo Bills are all that in a bag of chips and they're Toronto's official NFL team, how do you then say, okay, well, now the Toronto Huskies have come to town and you have to hate the Bills because they're our arch rival across the border? Like, that doesn't make sense to me. So I'm not saying the NFL's never come to Toronto. I'm not saying that this isn't a possible Trojan horse as part of a long-term play. And I'm not saying that it's going to fill BMO Field. I think at the worst case, this is like the CFL's Mexican draft or American expansion, or one of those other weird initiatives that somebody tried and we kind of laugh in hindsight. It's like, oh yeah, I remember when the CFL tried that and it didn't work. Well, guess what? Sometimes you have to try stuff that doesn't work, and sometimes it does work. So I'm willing to give this a shot. I don't want the CFL playing four down football. I don't want the CFL adapting anything from the NFL's game. But right now, this literally just looks like, hey, the Toronto Argonauts through MLSE are attaching themselves to one of the most popular sports brands in North America. And some of the same people who have complained for years and years and years that the Toronto Argonauts don't get any marketing. Oh, the Toronto Argonauts don't do anything to get our attention. They're mad. They're like, how dare they partner with this super popular international sports brand? So I don't understand that. I think this should be given a chance. I don't think anybody should panic about it. The NFL could come to Toronto in time, but I actually have to disagree with Doug Flutie on this one. The Toronto Marlies and the Toronto Maple Leafs both do well in Toronto. I don't understand why the Argonauts couldn't potentially do well alongside an NFL team. In 10 years, the GTA is going to have 10 million people in it. You're telling me they can't fill two football stadiums with 10 million people? Like, every major American city does that with their NFL team and their local college team. I feel like they can do that in Toronto with the CFL and the NFL if that ever would have happened. But for me, this is not a cause for concern. This is potentially a nothing burger, or it's potentially something that can actually help kickstart somewhat. I'm not saying an overnight sensation that's going to turn the Argonauts into an absolute frenzy, but something that could potentially get more butts in seats. We know that especially young men in this country love the NFL a lot more than they love the CFL. If the Buffalo Bills are telling Torontonians that the CFL matters too, and the Argonauts matter too, some of them could listen. And I don't think that that's a silly suggestion.
You guys know that I'm as big a traditionalist as it comes when we're talking about the CFL. And I'll admit to having some skepticism, having some worry about this partnership and the nature of it. But I think you guys both raise some interesting and compelling points. And I think you're both right to a degree. When I look at this, I am certain that you're right, Dunk, and that this is a play from MLSC to try and get a potential NFL team in the long run. Now, I don't think that is realistic, and I side more with Hodge in the fact that this actually might push us further away from an NFL team in Toronto, because the Buffalo Bills want that less than anybody. So if, you know, Ed Rogers is going to go out there and shake hands and make friends and hope that gets him a leg up in the ownership conference when it comes to a relocation or a expansion franchise, and he thinks he's getting that vote from the Bills, why would the Bills sacrifice 10 to 15 to 20% of their season ticket base like that? They wouldn't, right? They want there not to be an NFL team in Toronto. They want that themselves to be Toronto's NFL team. And frankly, I think the NFL wants that too. They don't have a ton of interest in coming into the Canadian market because it doesn't make a lot of sense in the big markets that you could move into. Toronto, everyone goes to the Bills already. You got that covered. Vancouver, everyone goes across the border to go down to Seattle and watch those games. You've got that covered. By putting a team in any of those markets, all you're going to do is draw away from an existing franchise. You're not necessarily gaining new fans. That's why they're looking further afield. They're looking at potential expansion in Europe, putting a division out there with six teams or four teams, whatever it may be, because then those guys can play each other. That makes sense. Because you're getting new fans, you're getting new people into your stadiums, you're growing revenue, whereas actually expanding into Canada doesn't have the same value or the same punch to it. So for the Bills, this is a way of cementing themselves as Toronto's team. And even if MLSC is using this as a way to curry good favor or potentially, you know, get on the radar for the NFL, I think more likely than its own franchise, it will result in a minority stake in the Bills down the line where they can buy in, similar to what Tracy McGrady and Vince Carter and Jose Altidore did with that franchise. If they can buy a stake, Josie, I don't watch soccer. It's not a real sport. You go in there, if you go in there as a minority shareholder, I think that scratches some of that itch, because I don't think you're getting your own team in that city anytime soon.
I'll give Keith Pelley and MLSE credit on one accord. And that's the fact, fellas, that, you know, dare I say, there was more media to cover this announcement, however you feel about it, than has covered the Toronto Argonauts at either of their most recent Grey Cup championships. Like, I'm not joking around here either. There was literally a television camera scrum, video camera, whatever you want to call it, a print scrum, and then a social media scrum. And the amount of media there, and I suck at estimating stuff, so I hesitate to throw it out there, but had to be in the area of 50, if not more. Like, you had CBC, CP24, City TV, like major outlets in Toronto showed up for this announcement that, you know, essentially on the day was about kids running around on the field and then this partnership that I didn't necessarily think the messaging was so great in terms of the details about what it was. I think we'll see more of that potentially as it goes along. But full credit to Pelley and MLSC because there was a lot of media there and news media specifically, which is where you want to reach if you're trying to get new fans to BMO Field to watch the Argonauts or get new fans to cross the border, which has been an issue of late. I'm not even going to get into that, to go watch the Buffalo Bills. And I'm not saying that MLSC or Ed Rogers are going to get an NFL team, nor am I going to put a timeline on it. Because I think what you guys both alluded to, and I think I talked about it off the top with this, was the fact that even potentially a minority stake in the Buffalo Bills would be intriguing. But I'll point to the Toronto Blue Jays as a difference maker, right? When you have a team from a major professional sports league in your country, that changes the equation in a lot of people's minds, right? We're talking a lot about Canadiana now and buying local and our home and native land with all the stuff that's going on that, again, I'm not going to get into. Like, the Jays are a rallying point, I would say, for our country. I know there's a bunch of Seattle Mariners fans out there on the West Coast. But
that's ridiculous. They are, dude.
I'm not saying a rallying point. I mean, like, statement. I'm not saying a rallying point. I'm talking about, like, Canada feels proud because it's a Canadian team.
I don't think anybody outside of Ontario feels that way about the Jays or the Raptors.
Anybody like, else? Bro, are you crazy?
Certainly nobody out here in BC.
We should ask people our listeners. Listeners, viewers, send us tweets, comment on the video. Are you Canadian? And if so, which province are you in? And do you take national pride in the Leafs? And, or not the Leafs, pardon me, the Raptors and or the Jays, because I'm genuinely curious. I really am.
Yeah, I mean, let us know. Man, there are people outside Ontario, JC, that care about the Blue Jays.
I think the Raptors are different.
When the Raptors were winning, people cared. Those ratings were insane. So I'm talking about the Jays specifically here, and I think you could make the Raptors as an example. But my point was, if there's an NFL team here, it's different because it's Canadian. People in the country would support it differently. Like, you want to talk about that chunk, you know, 10 to 15% is what Pete Guelli told me, the COO for the Buffalo Bills, being Canadian season ticket holders for the Bills. That's 15 to 20%. If you had a Canadian NFL team based in Toronto, you would get, I think, a whole new season ticket base. Plus people who are interested corporately in Canada. Like Willie talked about this, that there's the potential for MLSE to help the Bills unlock some of these major corporate partners. But if you're like, let's say, a big Canadian bank, for example, why do you want anything to do with the Buffalo Bills who play in the United States? How does it help you? Like, and that's just one example. I'm kind of saying it because Scotiabank Arena, you know, Scotiabank has the naming rights for Scotiabank Arena. But that's some of the examples that I'm talking about. Like, it's different. I should choose my words a little bit better with the Toronto Blue Jays. I'm not saying it's a rallying point for the entire country. But when it's Canadian, many things around this country have been proven that that changes the equation.
All right. Is it time for JC's random neg lister, gentlemen?
best part of the show. Let's go, baby.
You know it. So this week, I tried to answer the question, who is the smallest school product on a neg list currently in the CFL? And there's no real effective way to answer it, but I think the answer is defensive end Kevin Orange Jr. on the Saskatchewan Roughriders neg list. He hails from Graceland in the NAIA, not even an NCAA program, but this guy I think has some sneaky upside. If you guys have ever watched Iowa State football, have you watched them recently? They got a big defensive tackle named Dominic Orange. They call him Big Citrus. Best nickname in sports right now. Big Citrus. He's on Bruce Feldman's freaks list. An absolute stud. Well, Kevin Orange is his older brother. Went to Kansas first and had to transfer down to D2 at Northwestern Oklahoma State. And then Graceland. I guess we could call him Little Citrus because he's 6'4", 240 instead of 320 pounds like his little brother. But this guy has some freakish athleticism. It's tough to find actual verified numbers on him. But reportedly, he runs in the 4.5 range at that size and verts over 40 inches. He's a former high school running back, was recruited as one to Kansas before converting to the defensive side of the ball in his sophomore season. Had 8.5 sacks last year, conference all-star for Graceland. This guy looks like a man amongst boys on his tape. Twitchy, long, just great off the snap, can be violent with his hands and bend the edge when he needs to. A little bit raw, again, because it's a lower level of competition, but there's something to be uncovered here, and I think the Riders agree, because normally when you've got a guy from a program this small who has had no NFL interest or signing to this point, he's one of those guys you can quickly neg list and sign. You don't have to keep him for a long time. They've had him on the neg list since July. They're keeping him around despite the fact that he wasn't in NFL training camp. I think he could be a guy to watch if he signs in Saskatchewan.
Can you guys name the well-known CFL player who went to Graceland? Not active, but recent.
Jerome Messam.
Bingo. Well done. Well done. Also apparently an alumnus of Graceland, Caitlyn Jenner. Who knew that?
I didn't know that.
An international celebrity and also a well-known CFL player went there. Graceland's in Iowa, by the way. I always like knowing where these little schools are because I find that information helpful. It's a time for Hodges Heritage Moment. On this day in 1963, the Saskatchewan Roughriders and Calgary Stampeders played to a 4-4 tie at McMahon Stadium. The teams combined for a single-game CFL record 814 punting yards, which means it may very well be the most boring game in league history. Two things strike me about this game, gentlemen. One is the 814 punting yards. The second is that it took place 62 years ago, and it was at McMahon Stadium, which is still hosting CFL games. Those, I think, are both wild.
Were the 4 points a field goal and a rouge, or were these all punting points?
I'd have to check. Actually, that's a great question. We should ask the league. It might be somewhere in the record book. I have not made note of it, but could be four. Maybe it was eight rouges. We don't know.
Let's get to my featured Canadian quarterback for the week, fellas. Noah Pelchet from the University of Regina, diced up UBC. Cover your ears there, JC. 25 of 33 for 360 yards and count them, three touchdowns with no interceptions as the Regina Rams improved to 3-0 for the first time since 2002. Ooh. Look out. The Rams are coming. Pelchet looking great after leading his team to the national semifinal a year ago and oh so close to beating Laval and getting to that Vanier Cup. Well, Pelchet looking to lead his Rams to a hometown Vanier Cup as Regina hosts that U Sports Championship game in late November. He was great in week three and consistently has been for Regina so far during this 3-0 start.
And the last undefeated Canada West team, Sask, got knocked off this week. Regina, 3-0.
Let's go to the 3-minute drill. Kerfala Exume got lit up in his first career CFL start at cornerback. We talked about it off the top, giving up most of the 9 catches for 238 yards, a single game career high for Tyson Philpott, who also got into the end zone 2 times at Mosaic Stadium. Will Exume ever start a CFL game at cornerback again?
He shouldn't have started in the first place. If anything, Exume, I would say, is more of a Sam than a corner. And I wouldn't play him at Sam. He's a great teams player. He's a 6-year vet. He's got like 76 special teams tackles. No, he should not start again because he shouldn't have been asked to start in the first place. He was put in an unfair position, in my opinion. Hamilton Tiger Cats linebacker Devin Verisuk released a video on Saturday. Speaking of transparency with injuries being the best policy, making it clear, releasing a video on Saturday, making it clear that he's okay after being taken off on a spine board on Friday against Winnipeg. How good was that to see?
It was fantastic to see. That would be the case when anyone suffers an injury of this nature, but it's especially good to see when it's a player having a tremendous rookie season like Devin Verisuk. Hopefully we'll be enjoying him on the field for many, many years to come. CJ Rivas was fined for his helmet-to-helmet hit on Zach Collaros and took to social media to call the fine bull you-know-what. Was he right to be angered by the punishment?
You mean bulldoggy, right? That's what he said? Bulldoggy?
I think yes, it rhymes with right. Mitt, Justin. It rhymes with Mitt.
Mitt. Okay, there we go. I stand corrected. But yeah, CJ Rivas was right to be angered. I'm like, dude, this was almost a textbook tackle. I get you made helmet-to-helmet contact. It wasn't even flagged initially. It took Mike O'Shea having to throw that challenge flag for the command center to give him a penalty, and in my opinion, that's all it should have been. I get we're trying to protect quarterbacks, but I fear that pendulum is swinging way too far the other way and that the rest of the players on the field perhaps, and I stress perhaps, aren't being protected in the same way. The Laval Rouge Or and Montreal Catabam met for the first time this season over the weekend. Which of the two RSEQ powerhouses took that rivalry clash?
It was the Caravan, and this game wasn't very close. Laval came in tied number 1 in the rankings. Montreal was number 4, I believe. They won at 38-28, and at one point led, I believe it was by over 20 points. I've got my Around U Sports column up for those who want to read about all the games in U Sports. Caravan, draw first blood in this battle of RSCQ heavyweights. They will meet again in late October. Kenny Lawler told Taylor Allen of the Winnipeg Free Press he felt disrespected that the Blue Bombers signed Dylan Mitchell in free agency before offering him a contract extension. Is he valid in feeling that way?
I think he is, and it's unfortunate because Dylan Mitchell is out here catching strays after having not a very good season, but Kenny Lawler is a stud. We've always known that. They should have been talking to him and clear with him from the very beginning. More desire for transparency in Winnipeg. Chad Kelly released a hype video teasing his return to the lineup in Week 15, then was left off the roster when the Argonauts played on Saturday. How do you explain that?
2 words. Chad Kelly. The St. FX X-Men pitched back-to-back shutouts to start their season in U Sports. Were they able to continue the trend against the mighty Bishop's Gators?
No, they got killed by the Gators. I've never seen a team pitch back-to-back shutouts and then kind of roll over like dogs and just show their belly. They lost this game. I think it was 27-3. Yeah.
They rolled over effects. Like bulldoggies?
Maybe not as tough as we thought. Sean Oakman and Sean Lemon were healthy scratches for the Alouettes in the team's Week 15 win over Saskatchewan. Do you see those veterans getting back into the lineup anytime soon?
Well, I was a bit surprised to see them being healthy scratches, to be quite honest, but clearly it had the desired effect because the Montreal Alouettes won and had a tremendous defensive performance. I still expect we will see them back on the field at some point. Sean Oakman, in particular, I thought had a great first half to the season, was quieter in recent weeks. Hopefully he can refine his form because the Alouettes will need those pieces in the playoffs. Doug Flutie told you, Justin, that Nathan Rourke is an NFL caliber quarterback. Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't, because we know this, fellas. Even though some of the people in the NFL can't see it when it's put right in front of their freaking faces, kid's good enough to play down here. Now, I know the CFL defenders are putting their superhero capes on and saying, hey, we want him in the Canadian Football League, and I get it. But all due respect, like, this kid should be playing football in the National Football League. Like, look at some of the guys who are, you know, even backup quarterbacks in this league, and you're like, yeah, Nathan Moore could be better than him. Doug Flutie even added Bo Levi Mitchell and Vernon Adams Jr. to the mix as guys who have enough experience that they could ply their trade in the NFL. So Doug Flutie giving out some much-deserved flowers to some CFL quarterbacks. Not like it's needed to say that they can or could play in the NFL, but I think there's some people that need to hear it, because if Doug Flutie's speaking about it, you know he ain't be you know what about it.
For Justin Bull, W. J.C. Abbott, I'm John Hodge. We thank you as always for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast, checking us out on YouTube. Please don't forget to like, rate, subscribe, do all that good stuff, and check back later this week for J.C. and myself doing our picks for week.